I mean, I think everybody became aware of the story through the reporting of the Georgetown Advocate. And once their story was out in circulation, I mean, the big question for us, I think, was to determine the accuracy of their reporting. And we spent, a good day kind of going back and corroborating things, talking to people. We had a reporter who ventured down to Decatur and knocked on Professor St. James's door. We spoke with the university and then other folks along the way. I mean, including some distant relatives, a variety of sources. So, I mean, we were satisfied that by our level of reporting that what was out there was true.
How much of it did you get to do out of contacting people in Texas?
Well, I mean, certainly I and others on our reporting team did some of that. I mean, I spoke with the folks at the paper and gleaned, a little bit of information from them. Others, we contacted the court system in Georgetown and got, a significant piece of the criminal file that existed, and from that we were able to draw out the names of witnesses, that were involved in the case and some family members, and then it just became kind of a playing a little bit of detective and tracking down some of these people and getting them to recount what had happened back in 1967. And we also obtained a copy of the document that was filed in another county in Texas, farther to the east of where these killings occurred, that was the name change document that enabled the professor to change his name from Jim Wolcott, which he had up until 1976, to what it is now, which is, James St. James.
What have you been able to gather about Dr. St. James to most media about the man he is now, and accounts from students who say what a terrific professor he is?
Well, I mean, I think the bag is pretty mixed right now. I mean, we hear the university had put out a statement that they really have not deviated from since putting it out last Thursday, I believe, a three-paragraph statement that praised St. James for a remarkable academic career, given the, I think they said, the challenging childhood that he had. That indicated that he would be teaching classes at Millikan this fall. And it also said that this disclosure was something only recently that the university had found out about. So it was clear that when St. James was hired by the Decatur College back in 1986, this was something they didn't know about. I mean, I would, again, stress that it seems a bit like a mixed bag. I mean, I know that there are people on the campus right now who, this is a very jolting disclosure to them. I mean, I think, in the era that we're in, post Virginia Tech, post NIU, these campus shootings, there is a greatly heightened sense of security on campuses across the country. And I think, a disclosure like this, while, there's not been any threat that the college has talked about from this professor to students or anybody else in the college community, I think that's the note that it struck. That against this backdrop of heightened security, people really wanted to know what the story was. Students have talked about his demeanor in class, that he was sort of like an older hippie type guy who has a ponytail. We talk to people who are in psychology right now and who credit him for steering them into careers in psychology. But on the flip side, there are people who look upon this as a blemish on the university. I mean, we contacted the mayor of Decatur, Mayor Mike McElroy, and he said that he wasn't going to outright call for his resignation. He did say that to him seemed like the honorable thing for St. James to do, given the heightened scrutiny that was coming upon this, and particularly on the university, because it's attracted a national following. I mean, I was on Fox News talking about this on Wednesday night, and Today's Show has done pieces on this. And so it's just like, it's really kind of an embarrassment, an unexpected public relations headache for Millikan as students are about to head back there.
What element is perhaps a little frustrating? Legally, he was not convicted of these crimes, but what else would you like to find out, since the professor is not commenting on this?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of things that I think people are naturally curious about. And one is that when he was cleared of the killings by reason of insanity, there was a diagnosis from doctors who declared him a paranoid schizophrenic. And instead of being sent to prison, he was institutionalized in Texas at a psychiatric hospital and stayed there from 1968, I believe, until 1974. And at that point, doctors at the hospital determined his condition had stabilized. I mean, I think what many people would like to know is, you know, what kind of condition still exists. I mean, you know, many people say that paranoid schizophrenia is a lifelong condition. I mean, it's clearly a lifelong condition that requires medication daily. And what is the mental health history of this gentleman? You know, there's also a question about, you know, he used a 22 caliber rifle to kill his father, mother, and sister. You know, does he have a permit in Illinois to own guns? That's an interesting question. We did backdoor that question a little bit and went to the Department of Natural Resources to see if he had a hunting permit, and he does not. But that's a question. I mean, does he have access to weapons? I mean, I think those are just sort of some of the baseline questions that exist. I mean, again, I think to your question earlier about the feedback, we've had a great deal of folks who have said, you know, just leave this guy alone. He's had a 27-year career at Milliken and hasn't disturbed anyone over there or done anything upsetting, and has attracted a following of students who respect his work. But, you know, again, it's the oddity of this story, the reason that it has, I think, taken on national significance is because when you think about, you know, a college professor, I mean, you know, yeah, you think about maybe a hippie, maybe you think about, you know, you don't assume that there's going to be this kind of violent past.
Well, just based on the other coverage we've seen, I have a hard time believing that he would be left alone when classes start.
With all stories like this, that you know, they sometimes take time to play out. And in this case, you know, this is a gentleman who is nearing retirement age. I believe he's 61. It may be a case where the university is, you know, certainly aware of the public relations damage that it's taking as a result of this. Maybe they're trying to find a quiet, gentle way to get him out of there. But, you know, it's something that we may not know for a while. On the flip side, maybe this is a guy who's going to be teaching in 10 years. We don't know. But I think the story still has legs. I think that, you know, certainly the response in the campus, how they react, if there are rallies in support of him, if there are people who are saying, I'm not going to go and take a class with this guy. You know, I think what we don't know, it's, you know, Milliken, of course, is a small liberal arts college here, and they rely upon a great deal of outside private money. You know, that's another question. Will this disclosure and the negative publicity attached to it that has, you know, really kind of gone from coast to coast as a result of this Texas newspaper's reporting, you know, will that cause any sort of fundraising to dry up? I mean, I think that probably is going to be one of the largest determining factors on how this story evolves. This has been one of the most unusual stories in my career, and it's stirred passions most heatedly on both sides. I mean, in a lot of ways, this kind of reminds me of the whole debate that we had over the abolition of the death penalty in Illinois, where people had such hardened positions on one side or the other of this. And that's what I see here. People either, you know, believe to their core that this guy deserves to be left alone and allowed to continue teaching, and that he is a shining example of how somebody can rehabilitate themselves, to people in the other extreme who are disgusted by this and who believe that, you know, you're dealing with young people and young people's minds, and the university giving a pass to, you know, this violent past in some way just overlooks the deaths of three people. You know, I did interviews late last week with two distant relatives, and they, you know, their take on this was interesting. They had lost track of where he was. They were surprised, like everyone else, to hear that St. James was teaching college students in psychology. And one of these gentlemen, he is the stepson of St. James's uncle, predicted that this was not going to end well for St. James, and that if all of the public scrutiny that occurs as a result of all this causes him pain, this relative said that's not a bad thing, given what, you know, what pain, you know, that family endured, and really a whole community. This town, Georgetown, is just outside of Austin. And during the 1960s, this was a national news story that rocked that town. You know, given the pain that all, you know, everybody felt as a result of these killings, if St. James now has to feel some pain, these relatives say, that's not a bad thing.
Do you know if these distant relatives have, now that they know where he is, have tried to contact him?
They have no interest in talking to him. These people don't believe that he was ever contrite or apologetic for his actions back in the 1960s. Honestly, they, you know, one of them I talked to said he was a little bit worried about having this guy know where he lived because he didn't want him showing up on his door one day. And, you know, I mean, you have to kind of respect that view, I think, as much as you have to respect the view of some of the former students who praise this professor's work in the classroom. And that's what makes this such a fascinating, odd story to come out of nowhere.